Welcome to another episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. My friend Rob Galuzzo is back, and this has been a blast, this monthly new arrivals thing that we're doing. We've got another round for you. Thank you for coming back, Rob.
Of course. It's my pleasure. And I've got a very diverse stack with me today, so
I like it.
I'm excited to jump in, including
let's do it.
Yeah, well, my first one actually was I watched this earlier this year, probably in January, so I could have squeezed it into February, but I'm glad that I waited for this episode because it gives me a little more time to talk about it. Nice. And that would be a little film from 1984 by Sergio Leone, called Once Upon a Time in America.
I'm not interested in your friends in high places, and I don't trust politicians.
No, if we listened to you, we'd still be rolling drunks for a living.
Are you broke?
You'll carry that stink of the streets with you the rest of your life.
I like the stink of the streets. It makes me feel good. I like the smell of it. It opens up my lungs.
Arnon Milchan presents a Sergio Leone film starring Robert De Niro, Once Upon a Time in America. The story of friends. As boys, they made a pact to share their fortunes.
Agreed.
Their loves. And their lives.
You'll put up and you'll shut up. You hear nothing and you see nothing. Just like you did for Bugsy.
You was better off you stayed in the Bronx.
As men, they shared a dream.
I swear to God, Noodles, you and me together, we can make it come true.
To rise together from poverty to power.
There they are. Horseman of the Apocalypse.
A dream they followed through two decades that changed the nation.
You ever think of setting yourselves up in business?
Oh my God!
They forged an empire built on greed, violence, and betrayal.
Today they ask us to get rid of Joe. Tomorrow they ask me to get rid of you. Is that okay with you? Because it's not okay with me.
Open it!
Whoa.
Yeah.
Heavyweight.
Yeah, it is a heavyweight. And so I picked this up. This must have been a blu-ray.com sale for like $5. It came up pretty inexpensively. I have a lot of blind spots in my Leone collection. I mean, obviously I have some of the classic Westerns and stuff, but I'd never seen this one. And of course it's Robert De Niro. It's the sprawling epic about mobsters in New York City. And so I've been waiting to watch it. The intimidating factor has always been that there's two versions on here. And the main one is kind of a restored extended director's cut, and this thing clocks in at about 4 hours if not a little more. It's 251 minutes, so you guys do the math. But really, so what happened was, I think it was literally, it just became my Sunday morning / afternoon / evening movie. I woke up one Sunday and it was raining out, and I was like, you know what, I got nothing going on today. I'm gonna watch this epic as if it is a binge worthy new series of some sort, and really get into it. And it's pretty excellent. I really liked it a lot. I didn't know much about it. It's based on a book. I should have done a little more research here. But again, it's been a while since I've actually watched it. I believe it's based on a book that Leone fell in love with, and it took them. And basically, this extended one has got 22 additional minutes of footage that is kind of sprinkled throughout. It opens really, like, super violently, actually. Like, you're kind of basically in the middle of a group of gangsters going around and taking out various people that know this lead character played by Robert De Niro. They're looking for De Niro. And so right away I was like kind of taken away, but I mean, that's kind of Leone's thing is stylized violence.
Yeah.
And I mean, I bet this is a huge influence on Mr. Marty Scorsese when he got to his gangster movies as well. So then basically De Niro kind of like leaves town and then comes back many, many, many years later, and you kind of get, it's kind of a Godfather 2 style thing where you're seeing him reminiscing about, you know, his childhood and his childhood friends in the neighborhood and how they kind of became local petty thieves and like gangsters. And then their key period in their adult life right before where the movie starts. And his best friend in the movie is played by James Woods. and it's De Niro. And then you got all these other great little, I wouldn't call them cameos, but you have little appearances. Joe Pesci and Burt Young have a great little scene. Trey Williams is in here. Jennifer Connelly, like super young. I actually think she did this before. She worked with Argento on Phenomenon. I think this is her first movie.
Yeah, she's really young and angelic.
Yeah, sure. And the actress they got to play the older version of her is like she looks. She kind of looks like what Jennifer Connelly looked like in the 90s. So it's really good casting in that sense. It's there's a lot of questionable things in here that wouldn't really go over in today's day and age. In particular, De Niro's character is not exactly likable.
No.
Yeah, he does some pretty gnarly stuff in particular to, not to Jennifer Connelly, but her character later on in the film. But it's still just a fascinating slice of kind of mobster life, that I haven't quite seen executed this way. It is way too long, but again, if you're willing to take that commitment on, you know, a Sunday or over the weekend to really even just split it in half, if you want, take an intermission. But I was really blown away by this movie. And then even hearing some of the, but there's some documentary behind the scenes stuff about how unhappy Leone was that he never got to really do his version of the movie, because I think they cut it so many different ways for different territories and all that. And so he never actually got to see this director's cut. It was completed after his death in association with his family, if I'm correct here. Yeah, it's just great stuff. Ennio Morricone did the score, so you got great music there and all-star cast. So Once Upon a Time in America.
Yeah, good stuff. I was going to say, if I'm going to let anybody captivate me for that long, I'll go for Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
He's okay to run 4 hours.
Yeah.
All right, well, you start with a heavy hitter. I'll start with a heavy hitter.
Great.
I have a little movie called Notorious.
Oh.
1946.
Going Hitchcock.
Mr. Hitchcock.
What's this all about, huh? What's your angle?
One angle.
What, last night?
Just wanted to be friends.
Friends, yeah. So you could frame me, huh?
No, got a job for you.
Well, don't tell me. There's only... Oh. There's only one job that you coppers would want me for. Well, you can forget it, mister.
Devlin.
What?
Devlin.
I am no stool pigeon, Mr. Devlin.
My department authorized me to engage you to do some work for us. It's a job in Brazil.
Oh, go away. The whole thing bores me.
Some of the German gentry who are paying your father are working in Rio. Ever hear of the IG Farben Industries?
I tell you, I'm not interested.
Farben has men in South America planted there before the war. They're cooperating with the Brazilian government to smoke them out. My chief thinks that the daughter of
of a traitor?
Well, he thinks she might be valuable in the work. They might sort of trust you. And you could make up a little for your daddy's peculiarities.
Why should I?
Patriotism.
That word gives me pain. No, thank you. I don't go for patriotism, nor patriots.
I'd like to dispute that with you.
Waving the flag with one hand and picking pockets with the other. That's your patriotism. Well, you can have it.
Yes, this is the Criterion Blu-ray, which came out recently, and... God damn it. If this isn't, for me, one of the best movies Hitchcock ever made, I don't know how you feel about it.
I am looking it up because I mix up titles with which movie it is. So talk about it a little.
One...
I know I've seen it. I'm
sure.
Just trying to figure out which
You've
one it is.
You've definitely seen it. So it's got Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman, and she is basically sort of called upon by the CIA. Her dad is a notorious Nazi, and they want to use her as a pawn, basically, to try and get to some Nazi folk, and she has an in with them. And so it's this really interesting and incredibly romantic movie, which I always forget about, because the idea is that Cary Grant sort of recruits her, but then he falls for her.
Yeah.
Not knowing that they want to do this whole business of having her basically prostitute herself to what ends up being Claude Rains.
Yes.
In one of his great performances. I mean, it's so, I don't know. There's certainly some diciness in terms of what she's being asked to do and stuff like that. But there's just some really great moments. And some of my favorite moments with Cary Grant. It's a tough character because he's kind of gruff and grumpy, as you probably would be if the woman you love, you had to watch her, like, you know, do these things and sort of stiff upper lip while, you know, still feeling the way that you do about her, still knowing that what she's doing is really important and that, you know, I think that's the thing that's hard to wrap your head around now is the idea of the Nazis and how terrible it could be if, you know, certain tides turn certain ways.
Yeah.
And that, you know, not saying that a woman should ever be asked to do something like this, but I was thinking if ever there was a cause, you know, to save thousands of lives, it's still really kind of scummy. But ultimately, I'm like, okay, at that time, I get how maybe it could have been seen,
folks,
and is,
folks,
very
it's,
patriotic.
It's 1946. Let's just context. We understand this is not appropriate today, yeah. But let's just go with the flow. It's just a story. Let's go back
That's
to
right.
the 40s
yes.
and know that this is what it is. I have this. So I have this in a collection. It was a 3-disc collection. They came out separately as well. That had Notorious, Rebecca, and Spellbound. And those are way out of print now. In fact, I'm looking up the collection, and it's $110 on Amazon, which is just amazing to me. And I believe they do have special features on them, but Rebecca has come out via Criterion and now Notorious, and I have to believe that Spellbound is probably not far behind. So did you get a chance to dig into any of these new features on there?
I did. I was just going to say, I'm not sure which ones are new and which are old, but the commentaries, you know what, the commentaries I think both existed on the original DVD, and they're both great. There's one from Marion Keene, and she's a Hitchcock scholar, and it's outstanding. It's a true, like, masterclass in an hour and 42 minutes. It's about themes and characters and story and symbolism, and it's just one of those things where you hear it and you're like, oh my gosh, there's so much going on in here.
One of the subjects of the film is Nazism, its forms of violence and what those forms of violence reveal about human beings. Another of Notorious's subjects is the taint of notoriety imposed upon or inherited by Alicia. And Notorious is a love story that shares certain features of a fairy tale. In the CIA and the Nazis, Hitchcock gives us a matched set of diabolical powers. Madame Sebastian provides a version of an evil stepmother, and the Sebastian mansion stands in for a villain's castle in which a beautiful maiden is imprisoned and being poisoned to death. And at its end, Notorious contains the daring rescue of the beautiful woman by a gorgeous, dashing hero.
What she has to say about the dynamics between the characters and story things and sort of the stylistic stuff, little things that Hitchcock does. Both commentaries touch on, you know, cups and liquid and things like that will come into play throughout the movie. And there's just so much going on in these, but I loved that one. And the Rudy Belmer, he's a film historian, commentary, is more backgroundy and behind the scenes stuff, dealing with, you know, O. Selznick and Hitchcock, production code stuff. He mentions Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid at one point, yeah. Because there's a scene from Notorious that ends up in Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Edith Head, you know, the costumes, background on the actors, how they ended up in the movie. He reads a neat quote from Hitch, sort of about how he got started.
When asked at what period he first began to have an interest in film, Hitchcock years later said, "Generally speaking, I would say that first of all, possibly from the age of 15, I was a devotee of film. I mean, I didn't read fan magazines at the age of 15 or 16. I read trade papers. So I used to be aware of the making of films and was determined to get into them eventually. I didn't want to get in as a director. It didn't occur to me that I would be a director of films. I just wanted to be a part of it. In the earliest days, I was in the editorial department and then did assistant director work. This, coupled with one's reading habits, which veered toward the adventurous, I don't mean Robert Louis Stevenson, but let's say Sherlock Holmes, and then, of course, John Buchan, who wrote The 39 Steps and many famous English spy books. I think Buchan's work was a tremendous influence on me. Having started to write, I became involved with the German film industry. This was in the 1920s, which at that time was the greatest, even greater from an artistic standpoint, than Hollywood. And I became tremendously influenced by them. Now, my style was influenced by the German, the angles of photography, the visual ideas. And it was the visual ideas that began to come very, very instinctively to me.
And there's more stuff here. There's a whole bunch of... there's a thing called Once Upon a Time Notorious, which is a 2009 documentary about the film featuring Isabella Rossellini, Bogdanovich, Claude Chabrol, Stephen Frears, and others. And that was great. And there's even a few more in here that I didn't get to. But between the commentaries and that, I was like, wow, this is high quality stuff. But in terms of the performances, I think it's, I was saying, it's one of my favorite Cary Grants because he's forced to be both charming and show this incredible, you know, sort of pain and anguish. And sort of, there's a great scene where she's basically asking him, you know, so the CIA wants me to do this thing, should I do it? And he has to kind of not tell her that he doesn't want her to do it. And she plays the scene not facing him, and we can see his face the whole time. And it's just this really incredible thing.
I suppose you knew about this pretty little job of mine all the time.
No. I only just found out about it.
Did you say anything? I mean, that maybe I wasn't the girl for such shenanigans.
I figured that was up to you, if you'd care to back out.
I suppose you told them Alicia Huberman will have this Sebastian eating out of her hand in a couple of weeks. She's good at that, always was.
I didn't say anything.
Not a word for that. That little lovesick lady you left an hour ago.
I told you, that's the assignment.
Well, now, don't get sore, Dev. I'm only fishing for a little bird call from my dream man. One little remark, such as, how dare you gentlemen suggest that Alicia Huberman, the new Miss Huberman, be submitted to so ugly a fate?
That's not funny.
Do you want me to take the job?
You're answering for yourself.
I am asking you.
It's up to you.
Not a peep. Oh, darling, what you didn't tell them, tell me. That you believe I'm nice and that I love you and I'll never change back.
I'm waiting for your answer.
What a little pal you are.
And then Claude Rains is great. Obviously, he plays the guy that she's trying to, you know, kind of infiltrate and get information from. But he really does love her. And so there's this tragic nature to him. He's incredibly intelligent and jealous, but also oddly sympathetic in his way, because you really do feel that he really wants this thing to be real. He really wants her to love him and wants to love her. It's very similar in a lot of ways to a movie we talk about a lot on Pure Cinema, which is The Passionate Friends. And in seeing this one again and seeing Claude Rains in this one, I was reminded how much PTA must love Claude Rains. Because Phantom Thread has got a whole lot of Notorious and Passionate Friends in it, and that's great. But I just, when you get to the end of this movie, there's just such a great scene, sort of a rescue, and it's so well played. It's like perfect Hitch. Everything is just so tense, and I won't give anything away, but there's some other characters involved kind of watching, and it's just, I love it. But yeah, I used to put this in my sort of rotating top five Hitchcock, and I stopped rotating them. Now I just, you know, it's whimsy determines basically what my favorite Hitchcock movie would be.
Yeah.
But this is one of my favorites. I don't know if it stood for you as one of your favorites, but it's definitely one of mine.
Yeah, definitely. You know, again, I've been kind of digging through. I had this set that I mentioned earlier, and obviously I have the Masterpiece Collection, which is kind of like the last 15 or so movies he did. And I've been kind of just slowly going into the Warner Archive stuff and going through his entire filmography. Now, like, now I'm digging up the really, really early films. There's UK Blu-rays of a couple of them, so those are on my wish list now.
Nice.
But no, Notorious is, now that I know which one you're talking about, this one is terrific. And apparently, while we were chit-chatting, I pulled up a review on High Def Digest that says it gives this Criterion like a must-buy status review, but it also says that the one dicey thing is that it, even though it's got great bonus features, only one extra from the previous 2012 release has been carted over. So I can't if I had time, I would have dug into the disc on my disc and let you know what the differences were, but I'm sure there's probably some articles online. So I mean, if you're a completist, there's a lot of apparently different special feature material on both these discs. Although this 2012 one's a lot harder to get now.
Yeah, I think I have that one. That's got Ingrid Bergman on the cover, black.
Yes.
Cover.
Yep, black and white cover,
I have that one. Well, I don't know if that's 100% correct, because I know that both the commentaries from that disc have survived to this Blu-ray, and whether or not some other stuff hasn't is up for debate, but those two commentaries made it, and those two are great. But yeah, this is, I wholly agree with the must-buy status. This is, had I been on top of my game a little bit more, or wait, this is from this year. I can't remember if this came out this year or last year now.
That's all right. It had to either be 2018 or 19. It's very recent.
Yeah. Well, if it is 2019, it's in the running for disc of the year for me. I mean, it's just so packed and the movie is so great. Fantastic stuff. Notorious. You got to get it.
Beautiful.
What's next for you?
For me, okay, I'm going to go with a Shout Select title. And this is 1968, one of my favorite Westerns, Clint Eastwood in Hang 'em High.
Those nine men, if you find them, they're to be brought before me alive. You're under arrest. Hang a man, you better look at him.
No!
Who do you want to hang?
We all have our ghosts, Marshal.
He's treed! Blast him!
I hear about this, not just in the territories, but in Washington. Across the length and breadth of this nation, they're gonna know that name, Jed Goober.
Fantastic.
It is fantastic. And I remember watching this quite a while ago. It's crazy. This is the 50th anniversary edition of this movie.
Whoa.
But I think the last time I watched it was on DVD. And I was just kind of in Clint mode. And in fact, watching this inspired me to dig out one of my Clint Eastwood box sets that had three Westerns in it. And I dug into those as well. But Hang 'em High is definitely at the top of my list as one of the best. And it's basically, he is a guy, he's just a drifter in the opening of the film, who was a former lawman, just kind of minding his own business. He's got some cattle with him that he bought off of somebody. And basically, a bunch of guys show up and accuse him of killing a man and stealing all his cattle. And basically, they hang and execute him right there on the spot. But then, as the tagline says, where is it? Yes. The hanging was the best show in town, which is not true because they didn't do it in town. they made two mistakes. They hung the wrong man and they didn't finish the job. So, that sums it up. And so basically he survives and goes into town. And of course he wants revenge, but basically Pat Hingle, who is Commissioner Gordon from the Tim Burton Batman movies, Pat Hingle basically makes him like a deputy. He's like, look, why don't you work for me? Work for the law. If you have law experience, then let's bring him in the good old-fashioned way and make him pay. Let's hang him. It's an interesting take on vengeance and justice and the lengths you go to. And there's actually this one long drawn out scene that I don't remember. I mean, maybe I just mixed these movies up. I thought the ending of this movie was very different than what I remember it being because it kind of ends abruptly, like as if they're almost setting up like there could have been a sequel. And I went online to be like, did he ever do a sequel to this one? Because I don't know. I mean, the man constantly would, the man with no name would constantly go places, and he's pretty much playing the same character. But no, there's a giant sequence basically with a public hanging. And I just, I don't know. Maybe I'm just sensitive nowadays, but it's drawn out. It's like these two young kids that were brothers that got caught up in a crime, and so they're, you know, basically Clint was trying to plead for them and say, hey, they are young guys. They don't deserve to die for stupid mistakes because they followed the wrong person. And it's like, nope, they're going up against it. And I just found it. There's something, I'm a horror guy, but I find something far more horrific about a group of townspeople whose entertainment for the week or month or whatever it is watching people die. I just, that disturbs me more than anything that I see in any horror movie, quite frankly, is scenes of hanging. But anyway, besides that, there's some commentaries on here. There's two commentaries. There's one with film historian Jim Hemphill, which I have not had a chance to get to yet. But more importantly, there's a new commentary with Lem Dobbs, the screenwriter, and our friend Nick Redman of Twilight Time, who sadly is no longer with us. And I think this was fairly recent because I think they make reference that they recorded it in November of 2018.
Oh, wow.
So I think it could very well be the last commentary that Nick had recorded. But yet again, I mean, these guys are just so full of great tidbits and, more importantly, context, because I just always think of Clint Eastwood as this major Western star, and they were basically saying that this was considered a B-picture. And he wasn't really quite there yet in terms of popularity. This was kind of the one of the films that kind of paved the way for that, because the Leone films, even though they're classics now, were not really considered classics when they came out in America. They were considered hyper-violent and kind of crazy movies. It was much later that they got that notoriety. So you could learn a lot about that and just the basic history, you know, the context of Clint and his history in the film business just from this commentary from these guys, which is just terrific. So kudos to Shout Select. I've been enjoying a lot of the stuff they've been doing. Obviously, Scream Factory, they always do a great job. But Hang 'Em High is pretty solid stuff. And I can't believe it's been 50 years since this movie came out. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
I picked this one up. I have not dug into it at all. But I did not know it had two commentaries. So the Lem Dobbs and Nick sounds great. I'm a big Jim Hemphill fan. And I've actually... I want to try and get him on the show at some point.
Oh, cool.
Because I've had him. He's interacted with me online. I think he listens to the show. He's a good dude and a very, you know, knowledgeable guy, filmmaker and cinephile. And so two tracks on that disc is pretty exciting to me. I'm glad I have this on my shelf and I can go dig into it very soon. But we're in simpatico tonight because I'm gonna see your Shout Select with another Shout Select.
Nice
title. I have in my hands here Suburbia from 1983.
Meet the kids from Suburbia. There's Jack.
Wake up and smell the coffee, man.
Sheila.
Fast and the stars are ready.
Joe.
That could be there all your life.
And Ethan.
I feel kind of scared.
You'll love them. Or hate them.
Metal rejects running wild in our streets.
Welcome, Dano.
Their music.
Don't give a goddamn close back.
We're talking about kids. Kids like yours and mine.
Well, I'm damn sure they aren't my kids.
Their home.
This is the best home any of us ever had. Besides, if we didn't have each other, we wouldn't have anything.
And nobody's gonna take it away from them.
You shut up!
You molested your own daughter, you scumbag.
Hasta luego, shitface.
A new movie about a new generation. Suburbia.
So this one is the Penelope Spheeris film, not the Richard Linklater film that would come out later. And it is basically about a bunch of kids living in sort of a burnt out area of Los Angeles. They are outcasts, punk kids, if you will. And they have this, like, I forget why the housing development they're in is, it's like these houses were abandoned for some reason. And so some of these kids have decided to live in one of the houses. And I love the idea that they call themselves the Rejected. And in order to get into the house, you have to brand yourself with this, like, homemade branding iron that they've made that says TR on it. So you become part of the, you know, TR group. But, you know, one of the guys is basically saying, this is just to make sure we don't get a whole bunch of idiots, you know, staying here. You have to be committed to do this, which I think is great. But the movie opens in this really crazy way. It, like, opens on this, the edge of the freeway, it cuts over to a phone booth, and this woman has her little boy with her, and she's trying to make a phone call, and then suddenly this, like, Doberman shows up from out of nowhere, and you're like, oh shit, what's going on here? And the dog, like, goes after the kid, and, like, it's just this crazy, you know, scene at the beginning. You find out that there's actually this pack of wild dogs, like, roaming around this area where these kids live, and it's nuts. But it's interesting. It lives somewhere between, it's sort of like a darker, lower budget, over the edge type movie.
Yeah.
That world. And also you could say somewhere between Over the Edge and River's Edge.
Oh man.
It's like one of those kind of movies. I don't like it as much as either of those. I mean, those are two of my all time favorite movies.
Same here.
But I would say if you like those films, then you will certainly appreciate the milieu of this movie. You know, all three films feature kids forming these family units with other kids. This movie has a lot of parallels with Over the Edge, specifically in that there's, like, a neighborhood meeting scene where, you know, the local, you know, adults talk about, like, what they're going to do about these kids. Because one of the things the kids do is that they will, you know, roam from house to house, breaking into people's garages and stealing shit to, you know, stay alive, stealing food and whatnot. And eventually they've just sort of blown their low profile status. So they sort of put themselves at odds with the townspeople or the local adults. But it's got a really interesting cast. I don't know too many of them except Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers is one of them. And he's great. He has two wild Dobermans as his pets. And he also has a pet rat that will sit on his shoulder with him at times, which I thought was amusing. I don't know, the kids, a lot of them feel like non-actors or, you know, young-ish actors, so that has a certain either authenticity, if you will, or it may take you out, depending on, you know, how you deal with that sort of thing. But for me, I find it draws me in. And the kids have this really amazing loyalty to each other that's kind of touching. And there's this amazing walking shot of the kids strolling through a suburban neighborhood in slow motion. It's the poster shot, if you will, of this whole group. And they look pretty nuts when they're you know, gathered in a group, you know, mohawks and leather and just pretty ragged clothing. They make you want to sort of take a step back. But it's a really iconic shot, you know, as iconic and fun in its way as the, you know, Right Stuff shot in some respects. The world here somehow, this is just something you thought you'd appreciate. It reminds me of, like, a slightly toned down, dialed back version of the evil alternate 1985 from Back to the Future 2. It just feels like the burnt out neighborhoods, like, could be, you know, just shy of, you know, Hill Valley somehow. But anyway, it's a really great sort of cult item. I really like that they put this out. It's a new 4K scan of the film elements. Shout had put this out on DVD previously, but it's a new transfer. They're porting over the commentary tracks. You have an audio commentary with writer-director Penelope Spheeris, and then an audio commentary with Penelope Spheeris, producer Burt Dragon, and actress Jennifer Clay. And those are the main special features, but both are pretty interesting tracks. You know, it's very much a commentary track. I mean, like, there is moments of quiet. There is moments of them recalling things. It's by no means a film scholar track. But with a movie like this, I think it works just to kind of get a sense of the experience from the filmmakers and the actors involved and stuff. Anyway, I think it's a great special edition. I'm really psyched that it's a cult favorite, and I'm really happy that Shout Select brought it out in this collector's edition. That's Suburbia.
Very cool. Yeah, I got to check that one out. I have like zero memory. It's a blind, like I love Over the Edge. I love River's Edge. I have no memory of this movie. And yet when I see photos from it, I feel like I must have rented it at some point. So that's when I love to revisit these types of movies, when they're these new restored versions, because then you're like, wow, it's like seeing it for the first time again.
Totally. And that's how it was for me. I had seen it, but this rewatch was revelatory. It was nice.
Nice. Well, I'm going to throw a curveball at you, mainly because I want to talk about this franchise.
All right.
So it's a double feature that featured an entry in this series that I had never seen. So that is my pick. This is from Mill Creek Entertainment, which means that it's got no features. It doesn't even have subtitles. I'm talking about The Karate Kid Part 3 and The Next Karate Kid.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, if you own Karate Kid and Karate Kid 2, which I do, I think those movies are masterpieces and a perfect double feature. Quite frankly, there's no more story to tell unless you cut ahead to Cobra Kai with the excellent YouTube Red Series.
That.
Oh, man, it is like beyond exceptional. Like there's no reason that a sequel should be that good. By the way, they do make reference to Karate Kid 3, so it's all canon. It all works.
That's great.
But yeah, my argument has always been like, all right, so part one, he fights for the tournament, and part two, he fights for his life. It's a duel to the death. You can't get any cooler than that. And so 3 never really worked 100% because of that. But I'll get back to that in a second, because there's something very specific I need to tell this audience about The Karate Kid 3, which is there is a good movie in there. You just don't know how to watch it, and I'm going to help you. But let me cut ahead. I had never seen The Next Karate Kid with Hilary Swank taking over as the new Karate Kid. And let me tell you, this is not a good movie.
Oh, shit.
The Next Karate Kid.
Mr. Miyagi is teaching you karate, huh?
Not at all.
If I try to kiss you, will you use it?
She's like no student he's ever had.
How was school to?
What's wrong with you? Are you crazy?
Miyagi have much to learn about the girl. Oh, it's easier.
I've yet to see it. I've seen little bits of it, and I own it somehow digitally or something.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
I was hoping, because it's 107 minutes long. Hilary Swank's in it, and basically she's kind of like this rebellious teen, and like it just doesn't have the I can't explain it. I just don't think the story works in that, like, they should have just remade the first movie, but like, aww, they kind of don't get those beats right. Like, Mr. Miyagi's friends with her mom, and he happens to see her being rebellious, but like, there's nothing in her, like, she's not getting picked on, or you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing about her that he should feel the need to. Basically, her mom has to go out of town, and so he decides, he volunteers to watch over her. And she's rebellious with everybody, she's rebellious at school, blah, blah, blah. And she's kind of in this, you know, she's pitted against these military students. And so it's like, I never know if, like, are they going to fight? Like, it's like a bunch of, like, bully guys from a military school going to fight a girl? Like, why would they pick on a girl? That never happens. There's a love interest that does kind of get involved quite regularly. But more importantly, the head of this military school is Michael Ironside. So you have got a lot of elements that should work, and yet it doesn't. There's also no real, it just like keeps going and going. And at some point, I guess to teach her patience, like Mr. Miyagi basically takes her to like a Buddhist colony with monks. So there's like a whole long sequence where they're just hanging out with monks, and she, you know, they're like all praying or whatever, and she sees a cockroach run by and just squashes it with her hand, and the monks just all get up like disappointed, like there's no helping this girl. And they walk out. I'm like, did we forget the fly scene in the original movie? Or I don't understand, you know, roach versus fly, but whatever. And then honestly, I don't even want to call it a fight. Like there's sort of a fight. Like the movie feels like it's an attorney, and then there's sort of a fight. And then it's over. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, it wasn't like leading towards some big event, some big showdown, some reason for these characters to fight. So I'm sorry, anybody out there, Hilary Swank defenders, I love her and everything. This is not a good movie, but I own it because I'm a completist, and I also own it because it comes with The Karate Kid Part 3.
The time has come when a student must question.
I know you don't believe in fighting, but this isn't exactly fighting, you know?
Not exactly ping pong either.
When a teacher must let go.
Miyagi always train you, but for tournament, cannot.
When a conspiracy is planned.
You said that if I beat this LaRusso kid in the El Valle tournament, that you give me 25% of your new dojo.
When a trap is set.
You know how to front sweep?
Not really. Do you know how to sweep?
Of course. Ah! Or like this. And left to say.
Right. It's no joke.
I need your title. You don't enter, that affects my financial future, Daniel. Get it? Ah! You think you can rely on that crane crap?
Last time you weren't fighting this.
Mr. Miyagi loves you. He has faith in you.
This guy wants to break you, humiliate you, stomp you into the ground. Yes!
I'm sorry if you don't like it, but I got problems, and if you're not going to be part of the solution, don't give me a hard time about it.
Now, the man must make a choice, and the kid must become a man.
You are going to defend. You're getting in that ring.
What am I doing?
First he suffers, then he suffers some more.
Ralph Macchio, Pat Morita. A John G. Avildsen film, The Karate Kid, Part 3.
Now, I grew up loving those two movies, but here's the secret, Brian. I'm gonna lay it on you. So,
right.
The thing is this: everyone always would say that Karate Kid 3 is absolutely an awful, awful movie, and I disagree. I think the problem with it, the running time on this thing is 112 minutes. So you got a 2-hour movie. I think you need to completely eliminate and skip the first 20 or 30 minutes of this movie, because that is the way that I always saw it on HBO. As most HBO movies, you'd never catch the beginning. They would repeat the same thing over and over again, but you'd always catch it from a certain point. And so, hear me out, audience. So I would always catch it from about the 25-minute mark where basically Mr. Miyagi and Daniel have started this, you know, new bonsai school, like it's a store where they sell bonsai trees or whatever. It's their new business. They're just chilling out. He's friends with Robin Lively, who is Teen Witch and also the most gorgeous redhead woman on the planet. But he decides not to have a relationship with her because he just got back from Okinawa. He still wants to be serious with his girlfriend there. All good. But then this guy really starts picking on him and basically wants his crown at the tournament. He's like, I need you to get back because I need to beat you and blah, blah, blah. And he doesn't want to fight. But it gets so severe that basically he begs Mr. Miyagi to train him. Mr. Miyagi says, no, this is for the wrong reasons. And then some suave Steven Seagal-looking guy shows up with a ponytail and whips this guy's ass and is like, I'm going to teach you how to fight this bully. And so you're like, oh, wow, a new sensei. That's kind of cool. And so he teaches Daniel, but what he's doing is he's manipulating Daniel because, big twist, he's actually working with that kid. Like, he's his sensei, yeah. And he's best friends with Martin Cove's character from the original movie. And so this has all been a revenge plot. And so when I saw this on HBO like that, I'm like, wow, that's really – wow, that's interesting. I didn't see that coming at all. And so, you know, the movie plays out and it's got a pretty good ending, and that's that. Then the first time I actually watched the first 20 minutes of this movie is when it first came out on DVD several years back. And I put it on and I could not believe my eyes and ears. The first 20 minutes of this movie is so awful because basically it's Martin Cove defeated he walks into a room where his super wealthy Steven Seagal friend is. He's in a hot tub, just getting off the phone saying, yes, you could dispose that toxic waste in that river. I don't care. like literally, I'm not even exaggerating. That's like a conversation.
That's hilarious.
Hangs up. Basically, he's like, hey, man. Hey, Martin Cove. What's going on? Why, you know, why? Oh, this guy and his, I don't want to say the derogatory term. This guy and his sensei embarrassed me and they took everything, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, what do you want me to do? I want revenge. And you know what else? I want you to make his hands bleed. Callback to part two. And I mean, they literally have like that Austin Powers style maniacal laughing, like, make his hands bleed. You know, and you're just like, what the hell? Why did they think we needed to see this? And so anyway, I think if you start any movie like that, you're never going to forgive it.
Yeah.
So my entire long diatribe is, if you skip all that nonsense that's at the beginning and just kind of kick right into the movie and make it a mystery again, now you don't know what this guy's deal is, it's actually pretty good. And it's kind of a good twist when Martin Cove comes in again. So I think somebody needs to re-edit The Karate Kid 3 and cut out the first 25 minutes, or just skip a few chapters. And I guarantee you will find it to be a worthwhile sequel. So that's my two cents.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I appreciate the advice for how to watch that one, because I barely remember that movie. I've definitely seen it, but far less times than the other two.
I'm going to go, after this episode airs, I'm going to go on my Blu-ray player and check the chapter breaks, and I'm going to alert you and all our listeners to where to start the movie from.
Excellent.
Which chapter? Is that all right?
I love it.
So that's the Karate Kid 3 and the next Karate Kid.
Awesome. All right. I am going to do some monster movie action.
Great.
I have one from the Warner Archive here. This is The Giant Behemoth from 1959.
Gentlemen, we are witnessing a biological chain reaction, a geometrical progression of deadly menace.
Look there. Two points off the port bow.
We must find a way of destroying this creature in one piece.
Judging by the beast's size, I would say it was powerful enough to drive a battleship.
Of course, its tremendous electric charge is what projects the radiation. That's what makes a creature so deadly.
Well, have you any concrete suggestions?
Yes. First, block off the Thames.
Now, this one is, interestingly, a bit more talky than you might like your average monster movie to be, but it's got kind of a British Hammer movie feel in that sense, because a lot of the action plays out in London. There's some great set pieces in London, but what they do have is it's an atomic age monster kind of thing. It opens with atomic explosion footage and then cuts to this actor, Gene Evans, who is a Sam Fuller regular. He's in, you know, the Steel Helmet. He's in Park Row. He's in a ton of Sam Fuller movies. I associate him almost exclusively with Sam Fuller. So he's very American. So you have this very American actor playing some kind of scientist talking about atomic energy and radiation. It feels, in my head, I wrote down, it feels kind of like a Quatermass movie, the vibe of it. And because of the London stuff, it sort of just, like I said, pushes into that Hammer area. But the effects are fun. They're by Ray Harryhausen, idol and mentor Willis O'Brien. They are a mix of stop motion, puppets, and miniatures. And the overall effect of the use of the various things is pretty good. I mean, for this period, you know?
Yeah.
If you know O'Brien's work from King Kong, you may be able to see some similarities, but the technology that he's working with has evolved a bit since that movie. And so sometimes he's changing things up a bit in terms of the way, the mix of how he does it, you know? So it's not all stop motion, and the miniature work is decent. The creature itself feels like a brontosaurus meets like an iguana in terms of the skin and the spines and stuff. But it's better than I make it sound, because the way that Willis O'Brien is one of the great stop motion animators like Harryhausen. So the way that he creates the movement of the thing and the sound is always a big deal, the roars and stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like it feels, you know, much more real than a CGI creature of a similar nature would. So I don't know, I like that kind of stuff. I can get lost in those kind of effects personally. I think this movie is for people that are fans of things like The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, the Harryhausen affected movie. It's black and white, So that may turn some people off, but I don't know. I think it's a good Sunday afternoon monster movie. I had a good time with it. I enjoyed it. Like I said, great set piece stuff in London at the end, which I dug. The big special feature on this one, which maybe is ported over from a DVD, but nonetheless pretty cool, is a commentary by veteran special effects creators Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett.
Huh. Which is an interesting aside here. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms was the picture that in many ways inspired Godzilla, but you know, Godzilla found itself in the pantheon of movie mythology at a much, you know, higher level than either this or Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, I guess, as a consequence of the metaphor of this thing having an analogy to what happened in Hiroshima, not, since the movie wasn't made that long after.
So, you know, I always love tracks like these where modern day effects guys talk about their inspirations. Dennis Muren would go on to work on Jurassic Park.
Oh, wow.
So it's fun to see that connection. Yeah. You know, there's clearly, like, you know what I mean? Dinosaur to dinosaur kind of stuff. Phil Tippett worked on Dragon Slayer, RoboCop, Dragonheart, Starship Troopers, among others. So clearly more dragon-y, monster-y. You know what I mean? Like, you can draw a straight line from these guys seeing movies like this to what they ended up doing and what we ended up getting out of the equation. So I found it a really satisfying listen and a nice sort of icing on top of a good-looking release. The, as usual, the transfer looks great from Warner Archive. So, solid disc, The Giant Behemoth.
Oh, wow. Okay. Let us see. So, my next pick, if you're listening to this, you should know that I also co-host a show called Shockwaves. And you should go back a couple of months to the beginning of this year because we had the wonderful Lynn Shea on the show, episode 128 of Shockwaves. And what Lynn's appearance did, she tells a great story about working with the Farley brothers, because I just assumed, I think when she shows up in their movies, she steals the show. And I just assumed that she had met them on Dumb and Dumber. She had a little bit part as the woman that owned, basically when Jeff Daniels buys he doesn't buy it. He shows up in the shaggin' wagon, the giant dog thing. Shit. It's for her dog show. Like picking up Mrs. Newtobier. Like he doesn't know how to say her name right. That's Lynn Shea. And so I just always assume that she like got along with the Farley brothers and they were like, oh, you're great. We got to put you in everything. But she told an incredible story of just how hard she fought to get into the movie Kingpin, which stars Woody Harrelson and Vanessa Angel, Randy Quaid, and an incredible, mean-spirited comedic performance by Bill Murray. Probably the meanest he's ever been in anything. So this, by the way,
he's so good.
He's excellent. He's so good, Kingpin is my pick.
From the idiots that brung you Dumb and Dumber.
You wouldn't happen to have a Phillips head screwdriver, would you?
He's the man with the rubber hand.
Oh, creepy.
He's the Amish kid with the golden arm.
Whoa! You could be a champion.
I'm just not interested.
You suck!
Now, these two pinheads will teach each other.
Can you just feel it?
About life in the fast lane.
You're about to embark on a great adventure.
Does anyone else want one?
I'll take a couple jugs.
Woody Harrelson, what have you been doing all these years?
Drinking.
Randy Quaid.
This is pretty good fun for only $2.99 a minute.
Vanessa Angel.
Get your hands off me!
And big bad Bill Murray. On July 26th.
Watch the door.
Get your mind in the gutter.
I will pay you $1 million to sleep with your friend here.
Kingpin.
Are you still drinking?
No. I don't. That's behind me now. I just... Why are you buying?
I have not seen it for many, 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 many years, but as soon as I heard Lynn's story about how hard she fought to be the very despicable, gross, nasty landlady, I went home immediately after that episode and put this Blu-ray on. And I didn't realize this Blu-ray, which is kind of norm for most comedies, has an extended version. So I watched that, an extended unrated cut. Look, it's been so long, I can't tell you what was added to this thing, but there is a lot of jokes in poor taste, as always. But basically, Woody Harrelson is kind of this superstar bowling champ, and Bill Murray is his competition, and he's very, very threatened by him. And so basically, he sets him up. He's also, you know, Woody Harrelson's character is also kind of a simpleton. His name is Roy Munson. And so basically, Bill Murray sets him up at the beginning where he gets in this horrible accident and loses his hand. And his life spirals out of control, so much so that there's a term now called Munsoned, which means basically throwing your life down the toilet, which is kind
of amazing. To be stranded in the middle of nowhere with no...
to be Munsoned. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I love it.
So basically, one day he just happens to come upon... Ishmael, this big oofish kind of like Amish guy played by Randy Quaid, who's really good at bowling. And Woody kind of infiltrates his community by pretending to be Amish and convince Randy Quaid to go on a bowling tour with him and kind of reclaim their glory. And then, of course, they meet Vanessa Angel along the way, who was Lisa on the Weird Science TV show. This is one of her, I mean, she's just one of the most gorgeous women on film ever. And in particular, like, this movie just captures her perfectly. She's also kind of the heart and soul of the thing, because she really is who keeps everybody in line. And then Bill Murray as McCracken, I think that's his name.
Ernie McCracken.
Ernie McCracken, that's it. He is the most vile creature. Like, I couldn't believe it. Is funny, but I have never... This is the meanest guy I've ever seen in a comedy of all time.
Tanqueray and Tap.
Keep them coming, sweets. I got a long drive. Do me a favor, will you? Do you mind washing off that perfume before you come back to our table? A little bad luck. If you had it today, all your dreams can go up in smoke. That's why even we veteran bowlers, we work our way from tournament to tournament. We need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra, is what it means. You interested?
Interested?
Interested. Would you be interested in some extra income?
No, extra income?
You want to make more money? Okay. Why don't you go eat that outside and then come on back in? Hi.
Hello.
Not you. Hi.
Hi.
But it's some of the best, most brilliant Bill Murray comedy. Not just the dialogue, but his body language and some of his physical gags in this are absolutely hilarious. Like, there's one moment where somebody threatens to punch him and he starts running away, but he's still trying to flirt with Vanessa Angel. And so he's like scurrying away and like practically trips. And he's like, Vanessa, please, I'm in room 138. If you change your mind, like as he's running away, and you're just like, oh my God, what a vile character. And then at the end, like, he's got a comb over, but like by the time they're in their final, his hair is just all over the place, and it's just wonderful. So yeah. Kingpin is one of the great comedies. I like a lot of the Farley Brothers movies. I really like their Three Stooges, believe it or not.
I do too.
But they had a run there that was pretty untoppable, which was Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, There's Something About Mary. This was like their golden period, and this is just terrific. I didn't dig into the features. I just watched the movie, which is worth the disc alone. this is Kingpin is just top notch. This is from 1994. If you haven't seen it, you absolutely have to. And by the way, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but there's a documentary on Netflix called The Bill Murray Stories. And it's if you haven't seen it, man, it is one of my favorite docs that I've seen in a while. And basically, you know how Bill Murray is notorious for all these stories about sneaking up behind people at the urinal and saying, no one will believe you, when, you know, to him coming up. And so somebody did a documentary about all the stories. Why does Bill Murray do this? Why does he show up randomly and just crash parties at colleges and do all this kind of stuff? And so there's a lot of footage of him doing all this stuff. And basically, it's the complete 180 of his character in Kingpin. So if you need a chaser, go check out the Bill Murray stories on Netflix after you watch Kingpin on Blu-ray.
Oh, I'm totally putting this in my queue right now. I love Kingpin unabashedly. I think it is easily my favorite of the Farrelly Brothers movies. And I like the other two of the big ones. I like Dumb and Dumber, and I like There's Something About Mary. But Kingpin, for me, it's got those elements that I love. It's a sports movie. It's an underdog story. It's incredibly cast. It has an incredible villain. I mean, Bill Murray is, like you say, absolutely despicable. You want to see him go down. And that drives the movie for me. And you really want...
Yeah.
I love Woody Harrelson. I'm a big fan of his. And so I love him as this character. And I want to see him succeed. And there's so many things I love about this movie. One particular joke that I love...
Maybe we're on the same one. So to me, there's one gag in every Farley Brothers movie where I laugh so hard in the theater I can't even hold I lose all function because I'm laughing so hard. There's always one moment. And there is one in Kingpin. I'm wondering if it's going to be the same moment as us. But basically, it's him attempting to milk a cow.
I gotta go brush my teeth. After that is
pretty good. I don't want to give away that gag, but okay. You'll know it because
it's
of that.
It's later.
I could not even breathe in the theater when that happened.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. For me, it's more of a throwaway joke. But there's a bit where they show Roy Munson at the beginning, at the height of his bowling prowess. He walks into a bowling alley and Disco Inferno is playing. And it's like, burn, baby, burn. And he walks in and some dude is walking by with pizza, and he just takes a slice off the guy's and he eats it. And they do the same joke over again later when it's older Roy Munson, and the music sort of almost does a record skip, and the guy with the pizza goes, "Hey, wait a minute." And it's just this great callback joke. It's super stupid and easy, but I just love that kind of repeated joke. I don't know. They were in such a great place at that time. I don't know if they'll ever quite get back there, but yeah, Kingpin is one of my favorite comedies. I adore it. Absolutely adore it. So great choice. Okay, so I am going to move on to one from Twilight Time. We were talking about Nick Redman earlier. This is one of their recent discs from this year. It is Beat the Devil from 1953.
Time. What is time? Swiss manufactured, French hoarded, Italian squandered, Americans say it is money, Hindus say it does not exist. You know what I say? I say time is a crook.
If we took a plane, we'd be there inside 15 hours. Instead of who knows where.
I don't want any more talk about flying. The sky is for the birds. My feet are on the ground. Both of them. Come in, Billy boy.
What's all the fuss about?
No fuss, Billy. We're merely wondering what course to pursue in view of this unfortunate delay.
Join the peasants in their revels. Go to church. Write your memoirs.
Very funny. I like an associate of mine to have a sense of humor. Good laugh does more for the stomach muscles than 5 minute setting up exercises. And now that we've had our moment of fun, and all the better for it, let's get back to the question. Doesn't this delay call for a cable to your friend in British East?
Mustn't send cables. Can't you get it through your head that the population down there has trained noses? They can smell a uranium deal like a cat smells fish.
But aren't you afraid, Billy, that when our little party doesn't show up on the date you said, aren't you a teeny bit afraid that your friend might use this as an excuse to begin negotiations elsewhere?
If my friend were looking for an excuse, he'd find a better one in the morning papers.
What do you mean?
I'm talking about the untimely demise of Paul Van Meer.
But I'm appalled, Billy. What an unwholesome opinion you must have of your colleagues to imagine that we...
Look here, Peterson, you don't have to convince me of anything. You don't care what I think as long as I don't do anything about it. And I won't, unless you ever decide to sic that knife-happy little junkie on me.
Watch yourself, Lenny.
Now, Jack, behave yourself. Sit down. For shame, Billy. I think you owe an apology to everybody in this room. And if you're half the gentleman I know you are, I'm sure you'll make it.
As I was saying, Peterson, you have nothing to worry about. My friend won't pull out unless I tell him to. For purely venal reasons, that's the last thing I have in mind.
So I'm just going to read this little description because the movie is a bit complicated, but really it's not. It's okay, well, it says here, the script, which was written on a day-to-day basis as the film was being shot, concerns the adventures of a motley crew of swindlers and ne'er-do-wells trying to lay claim to the land rich in uranium deposits in Kenya as they wait in a small Italian port to travel aboard an ill-fated tramp steamer en route to Mombasa. So it's kind of like a companion piece to Casablanca, and some people might flip out in me saying that because I think this film, though it has a cult following, is also got its detractors. I think the big reason you might think about Casablanca is you've got Bogart and you've got Peter Lorre. You've got Robert Morley standing in for a Sydney Greenstreet type character, but you've also got Jennifer Jones and Gina Lollobrigida. But it's just a great, you know, hangout movie. You know, John Cribbs, my good friend from the Pink Smoke, had mentioned it as such, and I can't agree more. It's really just these people, you know, hanging out and sort of feeling each other out and trying to figure out which of them might have the rights to this land, this, you know, uranium deposit heavy land in Kenya, and who can they swindle out of it, you know? And so they're just different groups, you know. Robert Morley has a group with Peter Lorre and this other dude, and you know, Bogart has his own thing going on, and then this couple enters town, and you kind of are trying to figure out what their deal is. And it's, I don't want to give away too much in terms of what happens, but because it's not really, it's more about the experience of listening to these people talk to each other. And, you know, I just think that the dialogue ultimately for me is pretty clever and interesting. And, it's one of those things. I think the script was by, or one of the screenwriters, if I recall, is Truman Capote. It's based on a novel, and I think Capote was one of the folks that adapted it. John Huston, the director, also worked on the script. It's just got a wry cleverness to it, and it's kind of breezy and silly, and I don't know. I love Bogart of this period. It's towards the end for him. I love Bogart in general, but anyway, it's solid, and it has a commentary track with our friends Lem Dobbs, Julie Kurgo, and Nick Redman, and it's great. You know, I love their tracks, and those three in particular really always have tons of interesting insights and, you know, observations on plot stuff and themes and background. And this movie in particular, because apparently it was a troubled production sort of thing, they have a lot of great stories to tell, and I really like the commentary a lot. It also has something called Alexander Cockburn Beat the Devil, which is an interview with the son of the guy who wrote the book, who has also some interesting stories because he remembers being a kid and being on, I think, on the set or something with John Huston. So he has John Huston stories, and he has a couple other stories about some of the other cast members. And it's a short, you know, sit down interview. And the guy, you know, it's one of those things where you can't help what's going on in the home of the person you're interviewing, but the guy has a bird in the room that's constantly making noise, which is a little distracting, but it's one of those things that's ultimately not too bothersome. But anyway, looks great. This is from I want to say there was a 2016 restoration done of this movie. And this is the other thing about this that's nice, is this movie had fallen into the public domain, so there's a lot of really crappy DVDs of
versions.
Yeah, terrible. And this is the first one I've seen in a long time that looked really good. And, you know, hats off to Twilight Time for wrangling this. I think it's a classic of sorts. I mean, it is of the period a classic, but, you know, should be talked about along with Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon. Not in terms of the quality of film that it is, but if you like that group of people and that the interactions, the way they play off each other, I feel like it's a similar thing, you know, in some ways. More comedic and breezy, but I think it's a lot of fun. I'm a big fan. So that's Beat the Devil from Twilight Time.
Very cool. Yeah, definitely want to check that out. So my next one, my fifth and final pick, and then I have a runner-up or a notable mention at the end here. I was waiting to record this episode because of this disc that I'm about to talk about.
All right.
Everyone knows my love of 3D. My secret for a while, because a lot of 3D films or 3D Blu-rays are not really made anymore here in America, was that I would go to Amazon UK for 3D Blu-rays, and most of those tended to be all region or region-free. Well, Amazon UK is failing me because it seems they are slowly phasing out 3D Blu-rays in the UK market as well.
Oh, no. Shit.
Yes. And here's the thing. I am a huge superhero fan. Spider-Man is probably my favorite. I'm not a crazy fan of his arch nemesis Venom, but if I'm going to watch Venom in 3D, I'm going to watch it in 3D. And yeah. So this took me a really long time to track down because basically every territory either has a 4K, a regular Blu-ray, whatever. But it was released theatrically in 3D. And so my rationale is somebody has to have it in 3D somewhere in the world. And I have two players. One's a Region B and a region free player. So no low limits. Finally, I tracked it down to Amazon Spain. Okay, so I had this imported from Amazon Spain, and by the way, if you need a quick tip on how to do this, just scroll down on your regular Amazon, and you could change the country at the very bottom to where you go, and it'll open it up in a new window. If you can't read it, your Google page, I do everything on Google. It will give you the option to translate the page, so they've literally made it very easy to do this, to buy things from all over the world. So I ordered Venom 3D starring Tom Hardy, the superhero movie that came out last year, 2018. And here's the funny thing. Even though the cover's in English, the back has got Spanish text, but it is literally region A, B, C. When I put the disc in, it automatically defaulted to English, both subtitles and language. So I really didn't have to. It's almost like they made this specifically for us.
Nice.
Even though it's technically a Spanish disc. Now the movie. So
I'm feeling really sick. I'm hearing a voice.
Eddie.
Bring me back my creature.
What do you want from me? If you cooperate, you just might survive.
You do not want to do this.
Do we have a deal? We can do whatever we want. We are Venom.
Okay, context. Venom, I loved Spider-Man comics. Venom was the biggest thing in the 90s when I was kind of reading comics. He was my unpopular opinion. He was my least favorite of the villains, only because he tied so much into like the whole Secret Wars and the aliens thing. And basically, I just thought he looked silly. Like, he looks like Spider-Man, the Black Spider-Man. And so I never really liked him as a villain. I always liked, you know, the Green Goblin and Electro and Mysterio and all these, like, crazy characters they did. So I've never been all that pumped about Venom. I kind of agree with Sam Raimi. Like, he obviously didn't want to put him in Spider-Man 3, and it shows because that's not a good interpretation of it. And quite frankly, I was just so happy that Spider-Man was now in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that I don't want these constant threats of this Spider-Verse that Avi Arad, the producer, has constantly been like threatening us with, like, oh, we're going to do Sinister Six and we're going to do all this stuff. But here we are, and this made like $1 billion. So we were all wrong, apparently. And you know what? It's not bad. It's actually really silly, goofy fun. And by fun, it is like they time traveled back to the early 2000s when superhero movies were just starting to happen, and they've just recreated a 2003-ish superhero origin story. And it makes sense because it's producer Avi Arad's formula. This is the guy that did the first Spider-Man, all the Spider-Man movies with Sam Raimi.
Oh,
he
wow.
produced Daredevil. He produced the Fantastic Four movies, and they all have the same formula from the early 2000s. They're 2 hours long. The entire first hour is always a freaking origin story. You don't even see the superhero, or in this case, the anti-hero. I don't know what the hell he is. But like, he's supposed to be a villain, and yet he's the lead of this. So anyways, he doesn't show up for an hour, at least as full-on Venom. And yet, I still kind of liked it because it's just totally a silly sci-fi creature movie, creature feature, where it's basically Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or The Incredible Hulk, where this kind of down on his luck former investigative reporter played by Tom Hardy, who, bless him, is really going for it with this performance. I mean, the accent, the it is a fully committed performance, and he gets bonded by this Venom symbiote that then starts talking to him. And so it basically becomes his evil alter ego that's saying things like, I'm hungry, let's eat somebody's head. And so, you know, if I was 12, this would be my favorite movie of all time right now. But I'm not 12.
I told you my 9-year-old, it is her favorite movie right now.
She loves it. She loves it, right?
Yes.
She loves Venom. So you know what? I color me pleasantly surprised. The 3D looks great. I'm glad I waited and got this version of it, because I think 3D makes tremendous CG extremely forgiving. And so the 3D's, I mean, even the menu page was just rad. So the 3D's terrific. It's a pretty breezy, light movie. And the thing that impressed me is they pulled it off. They actually pulled off a Venom movie. I thought it was impossible because he's so tied into Spider-Man right down to the way he looks that I don't know how you could possibly get away with doing a Spider-Man character without Spider-Man. And yet they changed his look enough. He doesn't have, like, you know, the insignia on his chest or anything like that. And they just made it like a really goofy, like, modern Jekyll and Hyde story. That's kind of cool. I can't believe it, but I kind of liked it. And between this and the animated film Into the Spider-Verse, which was excellent.
Oh, I loved it.
I kind of feel bad because we're going to keep getting these weird Spider-Man movies. But as long as he stays in the Avengers, then I'm all good with it. So, yeah.
No, I was surprised. I was surprised by this one, too. I mean, it's a little rocky to start, you know, because the origin story is so by the numbers and so obvious. But I thought once it gets going and once the Jekyll and Hyde aspect kicks in, I feel like there's a great interplay between the two of them that is funny and, you know, kind of dark and edgy, and I don't know, I got a kick out of it. And I think that's the stuff that Raven liked too.
Yeah, and you know, I gotta tell you, I mean, again, a lot of people, I mean, you could go on YouTube and find the honest trailer for this, and they kind of poke fun at Tom Hardy for being so method the way he is. But I watched some of the documentaries on this, and it is super impressive because he is also Venom's voice. And
that's right.
He recorded all that on set.
Wow.
Right before they shot it, and he heard it played back with effects the way we hear it in the movie in an earpiece. So none of the other actors could hear that voice, but he could. And so they actually show them shooting some of it, and I was kind of in awe with his acting because he was literally acting off his own voice as Venom in front of other actors and pulling it off the way he does it in the actual movie. And it's really impressive. I was like, all right, I'm going to give you kudos, man. You're actually insane. But I respect it.
I'm glad you dug it. I you texted me when you were going to watch it over the weekend, and I was like, oh, I hope he likes it, because I just, you know, it has the potential to go down in flames, and I know a lot of people didn't like it, but I just think it's harmless at worst and kind of fun if you're in the mood. So I'm glad
you know, it made $1 billion. They're going to keep making these movies, plain and simple.
That's right.
And for anyone else that's a 3D enthusiast, I've been on the hunt. It doesn't come out for another month or two, but Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, or I think it's called Spider-Man A New Generation overseas. I have yet to find a 3D version. However, I think from any of the territories, I think the French disc does have an English audio track and has a 4K and a 3D Blu-ray in it.
Nice.
So I'll report back to you. I'm going to be, thankfully, my girlfriend's in France, so
awesome.
She'll be picking me up Spider-Man A New Generation in 3D from there.
Nice. No, that's cool. I can't wait for that. That's one I may get in 3D, or I may just get the 4K, but I cannot wait. I cannot wait to watch that again. I almost wanted to go see it. It's still playing in a theater near me, and I almost wanted to go and take my wife and my son to see it because they haven't seen it. And Raven would go again.
Oh.
Raven said
yeah.
It's another one of her favorites. Venom and Spider-Verse are... So she's definitely in the spider camp, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad you were able to find that, and it looks good, and, you know, it worked out, you know.
Pretty wild.
So that's Venom 3D. I have, for my last slot, just a pair of Kino titles I'm going to go through really quick. One of them, definitely one of them I haven't seen probably since it came out, and that is The Real McCoy from 1993.
Karen McCoy.
Hey, Karen McCoy
was a real professional.
Doing what?
I robbed banks.
Hey, everybody, this is a stick-up.
J.T. Barker was not.
Hey, are you who I think you are?
You are, I can't believe it. You're my hero.
What do you want? My handbag?
I got a proposition for you. I know these people.
What people?
Well, people like Jack Schmidt.
I don't work for bastards.
Some people just won't respond unless you apply a little pressure.
Hey, what happened to you?
I got my boy. You want a job?
I don't want to hurt anybody. I just want the bank.
You can't break into a AAA rated bank.
You can.
Baxter.
Today, I'd really like to open a checking account. When the alarm goes off, it takes the security guard 6 minutes to get from their base to the bank.
What are we going to do?
We're going to set off the alarm.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This one was directed by Russell Mulcahy, who did Razorback and Highlander and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's got some style to it. Basically, it's Kim Basinger plays a, you know, cat burglar master thief named Karen McCoy. And she is released from prison at the beginning of the movie. Well, we see her get caught at the beginning and then go to prison. Then she's released. And she's trying to start a new life. She has a kid, and she's got a shitty parole officer, and so she's trying to make her way without falling back into, you know, her old habits, as it were. But she falls in with this really fun, goofy hood character played by Val Kilmer, when I feel like he was still in the very funny Val Kilmer, you know, phase of his career. I mean, obviously that goes as far as Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you know, so a little later than this, but it's a great intro to his character. He's like robbing a convenience store that she's in, you know, the gun he's holding, the clip drops out of it, and, you know, the guy behind the counter pulls out a bigger gun and like starts shooting at him. He runs away. But then he sees her coming out of a building later, and he's like, "Oh, aren't you Karen McCoy?" Like, and he's made a study of her quote-unquote career. He's a big fan of her as a thief. But then you come to find out that he's actually working with a very evil Terrence Stamp, who is the guy that was sort of her, not boss, but like, you know, the head of the criminal organization she was working with before she went to jail. And so he really wants her to pull another job, and he will do anything and everything, including kidnapping her kid, to get her to do it. So it's, you know, it's got some dramatic elements and some very comedic elements, especially between, you know, Kim Basinger and Val Kilmer. That stuff's a lot of fun, but it's also a heist movie, and I just think heist movies are kind of a blast. Even a bad one has these great elements of suspense to it, you know, built in.
Yeah.
And when you've got a good villain played by Terrence Stamp, you know, your movie gets a little extra boost as well. So anyway, that one's a lot of fun. And it was really neat to see it, because I literally had not seen this thing since it came out on VHS, probably 1994. And it was kind of a fun, you know, rewatch. The other Kino title I have is from the 80s. And this one I had seen a little bit more recently, but it is called Youngblood. And it's from 1986.
I've been offered a tryout with Hamilton Mustangs. I gotta play junior if I'm ever gonna play pro. All the scouts are gonna be there.
Dean Youngblood scored 92 goals this year so far for the Stanton Flyers.
Get him a uniform.
The doctor is here.
New uniforms for the playoffs?
Wanna go, pretty boy?
Come on.
You gotta play it according to their rules.
Maybe I made a mistake about you. What do you think?
The wire,
if I don't sign a pro contract next couple of years, I'm through.
What if it had been you? What if it was you?
Wake up, superstar.
We're in this together. You're a team, a family.
You need it here, and you never quit. Ever.
Goodbye, young boy.
Rob Lowe, Cindy Gibb, Patrick Swayze, Youngblood.
Oh.
This is a hockey movie starring Patrick Swayze and Rob Lowe. And, so Rob Lowe plays like the rookie, hockey player that thinks he's hot shit. And, you know, I think it's a minor league. Yeah, it's a minor league hockey team that he tries out for. And Patrick Swayze is sort of one of the veterans of the team. Ed Lauder plays the coach. Ed Lauder is great. He's got I don't know if he's got a toupee or what, but he's got some crazy hair going in this. But he's a great evil coach. And the love interest is played by Cynthia Gibb, who is in Modern Girls and Malone. And I think she's adorable. She plays, of course, the coach's daughter. And, of course, Rob Lowe finds himself attracted to her. So there's complications with that. But, there's some pretty classic sports movie tropes involved, in terms of, the young kid, getting cocky, has to learn to play on the team, be part of a team. But it's got some fun interplay between Swayze and Rob Lowe. And I just love Swayze, man. He to me is a favorite. And this is one of the sort of under the radar Swayze movies from this period that I don't feel like enough people have seen or remember. And, it's got I was talking about Kingpin earlier and the sports movie tropes. And, so I love, the setup of a sort of a big game or whatever at the end of a movie like this, where you just get, at least I get really swept up in it emotionally. And even if it's been cheesy throughout, there's a couple, like it's got a crazy cheesy opening, synthy song that plays over the credits. There's an even cheesier love scene with Cynthia Gibb with another cheesy 80s song. So it's got a lot of 80s stuff in it. But even with all that, when I get to the big game stuff, I always get sucked it back in emotionally. So anyway, I should mention the Real McCoy has a director commentary with Russell Mulcahy. And this one has an audio commentary with director Peter Markle. So you've got two directors' commentary tracks, both interesting. I didn't get through either of them all the way, but I enjoyed what I heard. So that is The Real McCoy and Youngblood from Kino, last two.
Yeah. I got to revisit Youngblood. That was an HBO movie as well. So
for sure.
I haven't seen it since the repeated cable viewings of it. And I do love me some Swayze, so... that's definitely a revisit.
Nice.
I had one last thing that's a notable mention. I won't spend too much time on it, but last year, 2018, we got a new movie from Shane Black and Fred Decker called The Predator. It's the latest in the Predator franchise.
Tell me about the mission. Did you see anything unusual?
It's above our pay grade.
Do I get a cookie now?
Look, I get it. Something went down in Mexico. Nobody wants any witnesses.
We need to know if you and your men pose a threat.
We're Rangers.
Hey, Baxley, if your mom's vagina were a video game, it'd be rated E for everyone.
Isn't posing a threat kind of the fucking point?
And I saw it in theaters. I thought it was okay. And then after that, there was just so much blowback about this movie and these expectations for it, and a lot of controversy. Olivia Munn had some issues behind the scenes, and so a lot of it just got kind of, I don't know. It got a bad rap, which I felt it didn't really deserve based on what I saw in theaters. But I picked up the Blu-ray. And which has got actually surprisingly a lot of cool little features about the making of it. And I got to tell you, watching this at home, I had an absolute blast. It's just a great sci-fi action creature feature, and I just had so much fun. And what I love about it is, you know, they try new ideas with the Predator, which, you know, when I first saw it, I thought were unnecessary. Like, I just like the simplicity of they're here to hunt us and that's it. But you know, they try to add new things about it, like bigger predators and predators doing genetic things to them to make them more, you know, bigger and more intense. But really, it's the this character of kind of crazy vets that are on a bus, and they kind of get like wrangled up into the story. And a lot of them are, you know, Thomas Jane has got like, is this guy with Tourette's, Keegan, Michael Key. Key from Key and Peele. Like, he's hilarious in it.
Yeah.
It's so many cool, fun. It's just like those characters that, I guess it's like in the first movie, you kind of get to know the personality of those characters in the same way that you do with aliens. Like, you just know the names of those fighters. And so this one gets far. I think people are going to rediscover this on Blu-ray and later on cable or Netflix or however they watch movies these days and be like, this is way better than I remember it being. So I wanted to throw some love out to Shane Black's The Predator, because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I am in the same boat as you on this one, and I've had multiple conversations with people about this where I'm just like, I don't know what people were expecting from this, but for me, I was like, it gave me everything I wanted from a Predator movie, you know? It didn't reinvent the Predator movie necessarily, but it did add some new gadgets and some new twists in terms of, you know, Predator characters. And it's got comedy. I mean, it was just fun. I don't know what, if people were expecting to have another experience like they had the first time they saw the original Predator with Schwarzenegger, I just don't think that's realistic, you know? But I had a fun time. I saw this in the theater. I've seen it again. I bought it in ultra high definition on digital. And
cool.
And yeah, I love Shane Black. Nice Guys is still my favorite movie from
yes.
the year it came out. And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I mean, he is incredible. I love the guy. So I do hope you're right, and I do hope people will get over this blowback eventually and just enjoy it for what it is, which is just
yeah.
a fun Predator sequel. I think Predators is good. I like all the Predator movies. I don't have a problem with any one of them. I think they all
they're all entertaining.
Exactly.
They're all entertaining. And if you go back to the first one, I mean, you have to remember that the lines that you remember being classic lines, you probably didn't laugh the first time. You probably didn't get it the first time you saw the original Predator.
Yeah.
It's from repeat viewings that you're like, oh man, that was so funny. Like, the Predator has so many like fun, sharp, really fast, witty banter and dialogue that again, I enjoyed it 10 times more the second time because I was catching more of these jokes and seeing some fun callbacks and stuff. Basically, there's one joke that they do, I think it's at least twice, maybe three times, but definitely twice, where they basically question the name The Predator as being not accurate. And I'm like, that is great. That is great stuff. So, yeah, it's just a lot of fun. I think people, if you've been turned off by this movie because of whatever negative nonsense you heard, like, just let go. Have fun. It's a cool movie.
Yeah, have a beer. Watch it, you know. I can't
imagine. Listen to it.
Yeah. You'll be entertained.
Yeah, this is coming from the guy that got Venom in 3D. I mean, it's just going to be fun, all right?
Absolutely. I'm with you, man. That's a good way to close this one out.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Rob. I love these episodes.
You got
They're
it.
Always a blast to see what
Me
you've
too.
Picked, you know. So, I look forward to the next one we're doing, but everybody, hope you enjoyed this. Have a wonderful and Blu-ray filled week, and we will see you in less than a month's time with another one of these. Thank you. We'll be right back.